Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan, and you're listening at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. Well, dear listener, today is the 10th anniversary of that awful day where thousands of Americans were killed, the day that precipitated so many more needless and tragic deaths. My own son, Casey's included. If you listen to my show, you know that there are many, many unanswered questions about that day. And no matter what really happened, the war of terror is still being justified by using something that terrified us, then unified us, then ultimately destroyed us. Instead of using that tragic day to reevaluate our national priorities, the idiot Bush told us to go shopping and travel, then embarked on his wars of terror. Today on the Soapbox, I have two guests with very intimate knowledge of that day and its tragic aftermath. The first guest on the Soapbox today is the author of the 9/11 timeline, Paul Thompson. Then we'll hear the perspective of an Iraqi-American, Dr. Dahlia Waspy. Our first guest, Paul Thompson, is an alumnus of Stanford University and the creator of the complete 9/11 timeline, available at historycommons.org. By collecting mainstream articles, government documents, and people statements, Paul has written a multitude of entries and placed them into a timeline format, like is done with so many crimes. Through these timeline entries, you are able to see many omissions, distortions, and contradictions of the official account of 9/11. Paul Thompson, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, of course, today when the show is airing is the 10th anniversary of the events on 9/11, and I believe there are many, many unanswered questions, but your website just attempts to put things in factual order. So what prompted you to become involved with 9/11, and what specifically influenced you to make a timeline?
Well, I'm like you. I think there are a lot of unanswered questions there. And I started feeling that way around middle of 2002. That was the time when a bunch of stories started to come out, like the one about President Bush being given this briefing called Bin Laden Determined to Strike in the U.S. And you know, that really got me wondering. And so I was trying to just sort of make sense of it for myself. And I thought, well, if I can put this in a timeline, that could really help. But it just snowballed from there. It just grew and grew. And other people started joining in. And here it is pretty much 10 years later. And it's just continuing to grow.
Well, you said the briefing, you mentioned the briefing, Bin Laden determined to strike in the U.S. George Bush was handed that on August 6, 2001, and I'll never forget that date because that's the date that 4 years later I sat in a ditch in Crawford, Texas, demanding that he speak with me, and it's also Hiroshima Day, so you know, that's a very significant timeline. And what was contained in that presidential daily briefing that he received?
Well, just a lot of different little pieces of information. What's interesting is that we now know that there were so many warnings that were coming in, and a lot of them actually were not mentioned in that daily briefing, which is kind of strange. But you know, certainly at that time period, and that's one of the things that really intrigues me so much, is that there were just so many different warnings coming in. For instance, if just from foreign government alone, you had the British, the French, the Germans, Jordan, Egypt, Morocco, Italy. I mean, it just goes on and on. All these countries were warning the United States. Some of them were really specific warnings talking about airplanes being used to crash into buildings even. According to 60 Minutes, there was a warning from Egypt where they actually said there's about 20 people coming to the United States, some of them trained to fly on aircraft, and they even mentioned the names of some of the hijackers like Mohammed Atta. So you have this tremendous amount of information coming in, and then the Bush administration basically did nothing. There was In the 9/11 Commission, one day they interviewed Norman Mineta, who is the Transportation Secretary, and they asked him,
right,
what did the Bush administration do in response to all of these warnings? And he literally said, nothing. And it's just staggering when you think about it.
Well, also, it's reported in somewhere, you probably know the direct source, that George Bush said to the whomever handed him that briefing, he said, "You've covered your ass."
Right.
Isn't that correct?
Yeah, and there's some strange things about that briefing. Like, it mentions that there were 70 FBI ongoing investigations into bin Laden and al-Qaeda, and there was nowhere near 70 investigations going on. You know, so it definitely seemed like some sort of strange ass-covering move that was going on there. But, you know, that was hardly the only warning that George Bush got. I mean, I think they said that he got some 40 different warnings in the months leading up to the attacks.
Well, you know, I'm kind of peripherally on the 9/11 truth movement. I think, like I said, that there's many unanswered questions. I don't have a definitive explanation for what happened that day. Many people do, though, you know, based on very flimsy evidence or speculation that, you know, Israel, Mossad was responsible for it, you know, 100%, or laser beams hit the towers and that the planes were actually just holograms, that, you know, the people on the flights didn't really call their loved ones or whatever. There's just so much speculation, not based really on any facts, going on in 9/11. And you've actually said you don't like to speculate. Why is that?
Well, you know, when I started on this this project of putting this timeline together, and if people want to check it out, you can go to historycommons.org. It occurred to me that all these things were coming up in the news, these interesting little bits of information, and yet it's sort of just there one day and then gone the next. People tend to forget this stuff. And so I thought it was really important to sort of almost be like a librarian for this whole issue, to have this documented in a way that's not going to go away, not going to be forgotten in a few months. If people want to come to the website, they can look it up and see it. And if I'm in that sort of role as some sort of, you know, archive or librarian for all these different stories, I feel like it's almost my duty where I shouldn't be inputting my personal opinion in on everything. I just want to state what the facts are. This is what such and such report says, and you know, summarize it in a way so that you don't have to, you know, read through thousands of pages to understand all this stuff. If I start throwing out this theory and that theory, then I'm going to be turning my back to other facts that might be contradicting that. So I've really tried to keep an open mind, and the other people who work on the project, too, we all try to do that. Of course, everybody has biases, everybody has their theories, you know, but you know, we really try to be as objective as we can.
Well, I found that some people are very dogmatic about their theories, and they don't think they're theories, they think that they're facts, especially the people who say that Mossad did it, and, you know, they accuse me of being a Zionist if I won't, you know, expound on that theory when, you know, I'm very much against Israel's policies concerning Palestine, but, you know, I don't see any evidence for that's factual that, you know, states that Mossad was behind 9/11. Do I think that they would be capable of it? Probably. Do I think our CIA is capable of it? Yes. Do I think that our government's capable of killing 3,000 of its own people? Yes. But I haven't seen any, you know, incontrovertible facts that any of those things are true.
Right. Well, actually, there are some kind of weird facts out there that you might have heard. There's a story called the Israeli art students, where months before the attacks, there were all these people going across the country from Israel claiming to be art students, and they'd show up at military bases and say they're selling pictures and, you know, really kind of weird stuff out there. And it's not some weird conspiracy theory. That was actually ABC News. They did a big thing on it. A lot of the mainstream people did big stories on that. But it was a huge leap from that, which is
right.
some sort of, you know, spies running around the United States to saying that Mossad did it. And I think it's unfortunate that there are people who get so dogmatic, and all these people are just arguing with each other, and I think they lose sight of the bigger picture, which is, you know, that amongst all the different people who question the official theory, it's not so important, you know, which specific little thing that you think is really important, as it is, I think everybody can agree that there are problems with the official theory. There are holes in, for instance, the account that the 9/11 Commission put forward. And as time goes on, we find more and more holes. And that we never really got to the truth. We never really had an honest investigation. It was a very politically compromised investigation. You know, the executive director, for instance, Philip Zelikow, we found out that there were all kinds of conflicts of interest. He was a close friend of Condoleezza Rice. Even during the commission, he was apparently having some phone calls with Karl Rove. And, you know, it's basically a whitewash. So I think people who really know the facts, have looked into the 9/11 issue, they should say, let's all agree that we've never gotten to the truth, and we need new information, we need new investigations, real, honest, independent investigations.
Well, what are some of these big holes in the 9/11 Commission report, you know, specifically?
Well, you know, a really interesting thing happened recently. About a month ago, Richard Clark, who was the counterterrorism czar under both Clinton and Bush through 9/11, there was a video interview. You can see it on secrecykills.com, I believe, and it's about 12 minutes. It's real interesting. And what he says is, he says sort of 3-4 years after the commission came out with their report, some new information came out to make him seriously doubt a lot of the story that the commission had put out. And in particular, I think the most intriguing thing that's come out in recent years is that there were these two hijackers, Khalid Al-Midar and Nawaf al-Hazmi, and they were in the U.S. 20 months before 9/11, living openly in San Diego. One of them even had his name in the phone book. And there's a whole big, I can't go into too much detail, but a whole big, long, tangled story about how way back when, even before they came to the U.S., the CIA found they had U.S. visas, found that they had gotten on a flight and came to the United States, and yet that information was never shared with the FBI or with other people in government. Clark said he never heard about this. For 20 months, the CIA knew about this. He said he's talking to people in the CIA every day, talking to George Tenet 3-4 times a day. Any little bit of information, you know, he'd read over 100 cables from the CIA every day. So there's no way that they could have known that and just accidentally forgotten to tell me about it and other people about it. It had to have been a deliberate cover-up that went on for nearly 2 years, and he's just mad as heck about that. And, you know, that was something the 9/11 Commission never got into and never figured out. You know, so we're finding a lot of stuff now that's coming out. It's a real interesting thing is that a lot of people who were in the FBI and the CIA, they were interviewed by the 9/11 Commission and different other, you know, little investigations. And they're now retired, some of these people, and they're coming forward, they're being interviewed. for the 10th anniversary and so forth. And some of them are saying, you know, I really wasn't honest back when I was being interviewed by the 9/11 Commission because there was tremendous pressure on me. For instance, in these interviews, there would be minders, government minders. Like if you're from the CIA, they might have a CIA boss with you, a CIA lawyer with you. And we now know that oftentimes these minders would be very intimidating to the point of even sometimes answering the questions that were supposed to be asked to the interviewee. So these people were feeling a lot of pressure to conform to a certain story that their agencies wanted them to, you know, to put out that would make the agency not look bad. And only now that they're retired, are they starting to be able to talk freely, and we're really starting to see just how much of a whitewash those earlier investigations were.
What do you think about the recent information? I don't even know if it's recent information, but I just found out about it, that Philip Zelikow actually wrote an outline to the 9/11 Commission report before the investigation even started.
Yeah, I mean, that came out, I think, 2008, and they had a whole table of contents, basically, for their book, the final report they came out with, that the table of contents was written before they even started looking at any of the information. And not only that, but they broke up into different teams, and some of the teams even had, you know, all the different sub-chapter headings and everything all worked out.
Wow.
So it was like a fill-in-the-blanks where they had all the conclusions that they wanted to make beforehand, and then let's go and find the evidence that will support these conclusions that we want. That's not any kind of way to run an investigation. You know, and there was just so much political bias in these kinds of things because you basically had five Democrats and you had five Republicans, and they were, you know, they're very partisan people, senators and Congress people and so forth, and they were really using the 9/11 Commission as a way to try to score political points.
Right, of course.
We're not really trying to get at the truth. And the whole thing became a political football, which, you know, anybody would have seen just, you know, from the way it was created, that it was sort of, you know, in fact, the two chairs have said lately, they said, we were set up to fail. They actually said that. They said we didn't get enough money, we didn't get enough funding, the way that it was done so politically and everyone was a political appointee. We didn't have enough time. They were set up to fail, and they were. So it's a real shame that they basically got away with it because they put out that final report. 1 million-plus people bought a copy, and I think a lot of people just thought, oh, well, looks like they got that whole issue sorted out. We found out what the whole story is there. When in fact we did not at all, and it's,
go ahead. No, you go ahead.
Well, I'm saying, you know, people say so. That was like 10 years ago. You know, it's kind of becoming ancient history now. Why does this matter so much? But it really does matter because so much of what our current society is based on this 9/11 incident. You know, we've had erosion of civil liberties, we've had tremendous military spending, different wars we've fought as a result. I read something in the newspaper today, really blew my mind, said that if you look at the total spending on the wars plus all the security measures, the homeland security, all that different kind of stuff, you put it all together, there's one estimate, it's been $8 trillion.
Holy moly. the wars abroad are bad, but like you just mentioned, the national security state that's arisen out of this must be, well, we know that there's so many people profiting off of even the X-ray machines in the airport. Michael Chertoff has an interest in those, so It's been very profitable for some people, but like people in my family, it's been very disastrous and very devastating. When 9/11 happened, I was, you know, I was just a regular American, and my son was still alive, and we were struggling like any other family with, you know, all the issues. But I think it was like a couple days after 9/11, if not the day after, George Bush was saying, I don't want to hear any crazy conspiracy theories.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as I heard him say that, and I wasn't even very politically sophisticated, but as soon as I heard him say that, I thought, well, then it must be, you know, there must be some kind of hinky-pinky going on if George Bush is already telling us not to question things. And the biggest problem, go ahead.
Well, okay, just want to, before you move on, I wanted to address that a little bit. I think you said that a couple months afterwards he was speaking at the UN.
Oh, was it months?
And yeah, but he did make that comment about the conspiracy theories. And, you know, and I think you're really right to have a red flag there, because I think that term conspiracy theory is kind of code for let's not talk about this. Let's put that off the table. There's an interesting example of that I like to tell people about is right when the Iraq War started, Tony Blair, Prime Minister in England, there were big headlines there because he said anybody who thinks that the upcoming war in Iraq has anything to do with oil is a conspiracy theorist. And it's since come out just in the past month or two that we now know that at the very time he was making that comment, there were British oil companies who were scrambling and talking to Tony Blair about getting big oil contracts in Iraq. So I think he knew that if you just throw out that statement and say, you know, people who think X, they're conspiracy theorists, then the mainstream media, a lot of people, a lot of journalists are just going to say, I don't want to touch that topic because I don't want to be tarred with that brush. And unfortunately now, the whole 9/11 topic has been so tarred with that brush that a lot of journalists, they just don't want to do any articles on it. They feel like I'm going to be, you know, people are going to think I'm wacky if I start looking into all these issues.
Well, and especially, of course, as soon as you hear conspiracy theory, people start think tinfoil hats and, you know, crazy cab drivers or, you know, people at home alone, and that's their whole life because that's what we've been conditioned to think. But my friend Gore Vidal says, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, I'm a conspiracy analyst. But even people on the so-called left, when you talk about 9/11, they just shut down the conversation and say, you know, it was exactly the way the government said it happened, even though they will scream from the top of the mountains that George Bush and Dick Cheney are liars and they're criminals and they lied about Iraq and, you know, sometimes they don't feel that Afghanistan was not justified, or they lied about Afghanistan, they're torturers, they're murderers, they're liars, but they think that 9/11, you know, the government is saying is exactly the way it happened, even though George Bush and Dick Cheney didn't testify under oath or publicly, and they did it together, which is, I think, the biggest problem I have with the 9/11 commission their so-called investigation.
You know, I think that a lot of people on the left, they want to be seen as credible in the mainstream, and they think, okay, if I touch this 9/11 issue, people are going to, you know, put me with that 9/11 truth crowd, and so no one's going to take me seriously. So I've run into that problem a lot, you know, with people who don't want to talk about this kind of stuff at all. And I think it's a real shame because this is, in my opinion, a really remarkable story, and the aspects of it are continuing all the way until the current day. Like, one of the things that I have always been very interested in with the 9/11 story, just as an example, is the issue of possible Pakistani government involvement in 9/11.
Right.
And, you know, and there's a lot of evidence that even way before 9/11, that Pakistan had a pretty deliberate policy of supporting terrorism, because they're involved in this war with Kashmir, with India, and basically India is a way much larger country with a much larger military. So they kind of felt the way to even things up were send in these sort of very radical Muslims into Kashmir, and you know, that could pin down a huge number of the Indian arm, Indian troops. So this was, you know, they for years they had openly, you know, allowing these training camps and Al-Qaeda and these other groups to flourish in Pakistan. Uh-huh. And it even goes even deeper than that, where it seems like there are many attacks, even recent attacks, that the Pakistani government was involved in. Like 2008, there was a bombing in Afghanistan with the Indian embassy there, killed 50-something people. The New York Times reported that the U.S. military found out from communications intercepts that was planned by the Pakistani intelligence service, the ISI. The same year, there was a big attack in Mumbai, India, killed 150 people. You may remember 3 days of these gunmen running around shooting people. You know, more and more evidence shows that was planned by the ISI, that there's actually a court case going on in the U.S. right now. One of the guys who was involved in the attacks was arrested in the U.S., and he's being put on trial, and he says he got all his orders from the ISI. So you see this long progression, and one result of that is that the ISI, Pakistani government, every day they train, they fund these militants, and then they send them across the border into Afghanistan, and they're the fighting U.S. troops there. And we're in this crazy situation where we're basically funding the enemy. We've given something like $20 billion to Pakistan since 9/11, and they turn around and, you know, and fund the Taliban, who are fighting the United States. And there's just no end to this dynamic. It just goes on year after year after year, like just a machine that just chews up all these young men and young women. And it's crazy, in my opinion, that this is still happening. And it goes all the way back to 9/11, and even way before 9/11, we see these same patterns continuing. And yet, it's like, I don't know what. No one seems to notice or want to change these things.
Well, it's definitely hard to be aware, and you know, especially in the United States, when we're so propagandized or distracted by things that are very irrelevant. We only have about a minute left, Paul. I can't believe this has gone by so fast, but I'd like you to tell my listeners your website, and also in just like a minute, what do you think should be done? What do you think? Do you think it should be a valid, transparent investigation, or how are we going to get to the truth finally?
Yeah, well, the website is historycommons.org, and recommend people go there and even join in if they want to help get more information out there. And also, I came out with that book, The Terror Timeline. I recommend people check that out. About your question, you know, the victims' relatives, the Jersey Girls and others, they way back when they said this should be an independent investigation of academics, of experts, not politicians.
Mm-hmm.
And I still think that's the logical thing, and we mm-hmm. still are waiting for that to happen. It needs to happen.
Okay, great, Paul. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to be on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox today.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me.
That was our guest, Paul Thompson. Our next guest is Dr. Dahlia Wasfi. Dahlia was born in 1971 in New York to a Jewish American mother and a Muslim Iraqi father. Dr. Wasfi spent part of her early childhood living in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. She returned to the U.S. at age 5, earned her B.A. in biology from Swarthmore College in 1993, and her medical degree from University of Pennsylvania in 1997. Dahlia is my friend, She's a fellow truth, peace, and justice advocate, and she's one eloquent, compassionate, outspoken, and amazing person. Dahlia Waspy, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's nice to talk to you. When was the last time we actually got to talk to each other?
I don't think probably the last time I saw you was in Valley Forge in March 2010, so it's been a long time. It's overdue.
Yeah, so actually, and we were actually doing a conference, I think it was called Treason in America, that had a lot to do with 9/11, huh?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, you've gotten married since then?
Yes.
Wow.
I'm trying to get my life back on track since that happened. But yes,
uh-huh.
Thank you for remarking about that.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It's actually in the midst of all this madness, I found a soulmate who has the same conviction that I try to have. Hopefully, I think we're working now synergistically, so we should really wrap up this whole unending war thing relatively quickly now that we've met each other. So we're counting on that.
And since 9/11 also, I've been gifted with three beautiful, smart, amazing grandchildren, and one on the way is in fact due on 9/11. And
oh my goodness.
So, I know. So, you know, it gives us like when these good positive things happen, it gives us, you know, so much joy and like dare I say hope for the future, but also a renewed sense of commitment. At least in my case, my grandkids motivate me to make the world a better place for them and, you know, their little, you know, grandchildren, friends around the world.
Absolutely. And this is the same thing. My only child has four legs, so I don't know what it is to be a mom. But this is the same thing I observed with my family overseas in Iraq, is that this is what they continue to live their lives. If they waited for things to get better to move on, they would never stop waiting. And so the next generation is being born, and they do the best they can for their families and they as well, trying to make a better future for those kids. So that's what comes to mind as you talk about, you know, sort of rebuilding your own life.
Well, also, it is the anniversary, the 10th anniversary of 9/11. I'm like fed up to my eyebrows with, you know, how the U.S. was attacked on 9/11 and we were attacked because the terrorists hate our freedom and our democracy and our way of life, and they want to attack our way of life. Well, you know, if that was true, they did a really good job. But there's very little talk about the people outside the U.S. that have been destroyed by whatever happened on 9/11. And you don't hear their stories and how needlessly and tragically their lives have been affected because of what happened on that day. So that's why I wanted to invite you on, because you're a very eloquent critic of U.S. policy, but you're also very eloquent in describing your Iraqi roots and what's happening to the people in that country. So I just want you to today talk about that. Talk about the connection between 9/11 and Iraq, and what the U.S. Did ostensibly there, but what really happened and what's still happening. Iraq has basically fallen off the face of the earth. It may as well not even exist, because we don't talk about it at all. It's
right.
Like, well, and Dick Cheney said it's better. It's a better place. You know, they have a democracy now and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I wish I believed in hell so I would know that Dick Cheney was going there soon, but yeah, I don't think that's happening. So, Dahlia, give us the Iraqi perspective on this.
Well, I so appreciate, I promise I'm not going to forget what is happening on Sunday. I'm not going to forget the anniversary. I don't need any more reminders, but I know more are coming. But Absolutely. I can tell from, you know, from my personal experience. I was born in New York. We lived in Iraq when I was little, and then we left when I was 5 years old. So except for a few years in there, I'm born and raised here. I don't even speak Arabic. I know from the few months I spent with my family what they have to endure on a daily basis, which is really something that I could not consistently deal with. They are much stronger than I think I'll ever dream to be. But what happened on September 11th, 2001, once it was clear sort of what was being built up, and I knew that no matter who was responsible, that Arabs and Muslims were going to be blamed in this country, because that's just par for the course. It happened after the Oklahoma City bombing, pretty much any time. It just happened recently with what happened in Norway, that the first suspect was, it must be an Islamic terrorist. This is where we're the go-to people. And while there still needs to be a genuine investigation, as far as I'm concerned, and many others, we still don't know exactly what happened that day. I knew that the next hits coming were going to be racist. And I certainly didn't face what others faced in this country. I mean, a lot of people died in this country after 9/11 because they were seen to be they looked Muslim or they looked Arab. And then what came afterwards was our assault on Afghanistan. Of course, the people of Afghanistan had nothing to do with September 11th, and the assault on Iraq, which started, the planning for that began on September 13th, 2011. The plans to
2001.
2001. Thank you. 2 days after 9/11, 2001.
Right.
And this was, it's very clear, I think the number is 965 times the Bush administration lied about numerous things, including supposed ties between Iraq and 9/11. And the outcome today for Iraqis is their lives will never be the same. There's over a million people dead, over 5.5 million refugees, and that's 20% of Iraq's 27 million population. From what my cousins have told me, there is no one who has been untouched. Everybody knows somebody who's been killed, either a victim of the violence that we brought to Iraq, or a victim of the destruction of the infrastructure and the healthcare system. And then on top of all of that, which returning veterans are suffering the consequences from as well, is our use of depleted uranium, which is a basically it's radioactive metal that vaporizes into dust. And this contaminates the air and the sand and the water supply for Iraqis. And it's in the air that that occupying forces are breathing in. So this is a gift of cancer for the next 4.5 billion years. And still, with that knowledge, in spite of being keenly aware of the weapons that we've used and the effects on the future generations, which is most vividly being demonstrated in the city of Fallujah after two major sieges in 2004, Iraqis, they continue forward. They, again, like, you know, trying to do day-to-day things, put their lives back together. But what they, the sense that I get to this day is they want an end to the occupation. It's very simple. And I think what, as I hear the continue, as we build up to this 10th anniversary on Sunday, there are families out there. There are in Iraq and Afghanistan where every day is their marker of 9/11. We have 1 day of tragedy to commemorate, but with the number of offenses and operations that we've conducted, there is a terrible anniversary for someone for every day of the year, and that's why you know that it's so important for those who have been affected the most, and you know, in my opinion, you have the most powerful voice. To say that, you know, not in my name, whether it's the families of the victims on actually the date of September 11th, 2001, or a military mom like yourself who's saying that this is, I know what the grief is. You walked in those shoes, and it's such a powerful voice to say it's enough. It's enough because it's in the name of all of this is being done for corporate profit. And while people are not waking up as fast as I'd like them to, things are definitely, we are day by day, we see differences and more people awakening. And so still, we're working for immediate unconditional withdrawal of U.S. forces and mercenaries and CIA from Iraq and Afghanistan, and an end to military aid to Israel in compliance with our domestic law and international law. And it is through those should be the first steps towards establishing security, I believe.
Well, you mentioned that 20% of Iraqis have been either killed or displaced or wounded. And I always point out to people that would be 60 million Americans.
Yeah.
You know, just think of 60 million Americans, something like that. You know, almost like twice the size of the population of California.
Yeah.
Wouldn't there be like a national and international outcry if 60 million Americans were killed or made refugees in their own country or, you know, in another country?
Absolutely. This is it's something, it's beyond our comprehension. It really is. And if we could see, and that's really, you know, it's so simple to me, if we could just get people to see other lives, the lives of people with other nationalities, other families, the same way we see our own, we would conduct ourselves in a much different way, and we would not allow what is taking place now. I still think it's a great deal of ignorance that allows these policies to continue. And so, you know, I'm still trying to sort of just show that every country is made up of families, and it's those families who either reap the benefits of what their government does or pay the price. And unfortunately, in many places around the world, from the United States to Iraq, it's these families are paying a price. And especially with the latest target of NATO warplanes now in Libya. It's the same old story all over again, and it's very discouraging to see a lot of my colleagues who have opposed the wars in Afghanistan, the occupations of Afghanistan and Iraq, to all of a sudden turn around and say, "Well, this is a good intervention," just to say that, you know, that with any military assault like this, 90% of the casualties are unarmed civilians. So you cannot make an argument to me that there is a good reason for that in any situation. And this is ultimately who pays the price. We've seen it over and over and over again. And once we recognize that, once that reality comes to light, I do think things will change. I pray anyway.
Well, and also with Libby, I always think it was lazy justification and lazy reporting for the justification for the humanitarian intervention in Libya, because I swear they could have replaced Saddam Hussein with Gaddafi, and they could have replaced Iraq with Libya every single time they talked about it. I was like, people, why are you falling for this again?
I know. It's, a brutal dictator who's killing his own people, and we have to go in to help them. And looking at the history, certainly the United Kingdom has done a great deal to arm Libya in recent years, just as we did a great deal to arm Saddam Hussein's Iraq. This is, it's a lot like professional wrestling. The good guys become the bad guys, and they'll become the good guys again, just depending on which way the winds are blowing. But it's really remarkable that any sort of military aggression is considered humanitarian, and that's the ultimate Orwell doublespeak. And I've had enough of it, as I'm sure you have too.
Absolutely.
The only thing is that as we are absolutely overextending ourselves. And while we are in Iraq, we are in Afghanistan, we are bombing Pakistan, we are bombing Yemen, we are trying to suppress the demonstrators. It's funny, they're valiant rebels in Libya, but they are insurgents in Bahrain, where the America's 5th Naval Fleet sits. All depends on what is in our interest for
right,
our
the U.S.
Yeah, so that's it. So it's the double standards are becoming more and more clear, and we are overextending ourselves. Meanwhile, back at home, there's no jobs. We're continuing in this recession, and so the connection should be made. The media is failing to make the connection, but it should be made that while pouring all this money into overseas military aggression and through the budget of the Pentagon, while our economy is falling apart, there we just have to connect the dots. We could fix so much and open new job opportunities here by, instead of destroying infrastructure overseas,
right,
how about rebuilding it here?
And making sustainable systems and, you know, economies instead of the one that we have now. Well, Dahlia, thank you for coming on and connecting the dots on Cindy Sheehan's soapbox, and thank you for giving the untold side of the story upcoming on this anniversary.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. I greatly appreciate it, and best wishes to you.
Okay, Dahlia, thank you. We'll talk to you soon, I hope.
Okay, bye-bye.
That was my good friend, Dr. Dahlia Waspy. Well, as always, today I'd like to thank my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my webmaster, Rich Bowser, my producer, Mikey, my guests, Paul Thompson and Dr. Dahlia Waspy, and you for listening. And if you have time, check out Time Magazine. I'm in it on the anniversary of 9/11 issue. It's called Portraits of Resilience. You can, I guess, buy it at your local place that sells magazines. You can look at it at the library, or you can certainly look at it online. Again, that's Time Magazine, Portraits of Resilience After 9/11. Thank you, everybody, and we'll talk to you again next week.
I'm your third man, girl. Yeah, but it's a fact that I'm the seventh son. You're third man, girl. That's a fact that I'm the seventh son. Well, now you can care less about me. Have a ball and a biscuit, sugar. Take our sweet little time about it. We'll be right back.
have a bone of biscuit sugar. You have to go sweet little time about it. Hey. Let's have a bone. Yeah, take a sweet little time. Let me daddy in the place to just get out of here.